Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when private contractors are hired to carry out U.S. foreign policy? As President Obama mulls sending additional troops to Afghanistan, the reality is that 57% of Department of Defense manpower on the ground there now is provided by private corporations, which may or may not have competed aggressively to get their bids accepted. And U.S. taxpayers have spent well over $100 billion on private contractors in Iraq, to the extent that they outnumbered our soldiers on the ground there by 20,000 in 2007. Those contractors provide everything from construction to catering services, not to mention heavily armed security details. But who is making sure they're really doing what they've promised? And does their existence make it too easy for American voters to underestimate the true cost and scope of our overseas engagements? Allison Stanger is Russell Lang 60, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. She writes about these issues in her new book, One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. Allison, welcome to Think.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Can you start by giving us a sense of the extent to which we have privatized foreign policy in this country?
Well, it's something that's happened slowly and over time, and it's really not a partisan issue. I would start by stressing that both Democrats and Republicans alike have outsourced the work of government to the private sector. And it's something that's happened slowly over time, and all of a sudden we're just waking up to realize the extent to which we've done this and that there's some negative consequences to it.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, as you write, we really began this sort of thing soon after the Second World War, and it absolutely took off not during the second Bush administration, but in fact during the Clinton administration.
That's correct. I mean, and people outsource for the same sorts of reasons. They're seeking greater efficiency. They want to cut costs. They're hoping they can, particularly in a war zone, get the job done well and fast, which is of utmost importance.
What functions do contractors fulfill right now that soldiers used to do?
You know, most of these things that are contracted out now used to be in-house. I mean, it used to be the case that you would have uniformed personnel peeling potatoes, you know, cleaning up around the camp, and now there are private companies doing that work. It's quite a transformation. You have contractors doing everything from servicing and overseeing weapon systems to providing food, to even guarding embassies. Some of them are weapon-carrying contractors.
And speaking frankly, you say that if we didn't have these contractors, we would, in fact, have to reinstate the draft.
Absolutely. I mean, the presence in both Afghanistan and Iraq today, private contractors outnumber American men and women in uniform on the ground. So if you were going to try to make that up with uniformed personnel without a draft, it would simply be impossible.
Does heavy use of contract labor somehow make us more complacent about combat operations overseas?
I think it just makes it a whole lot easier to, in a sense, throw money at a problem without really addressing it directly. It enables us to fight wars in faraway places, and the American people can remain slightly disengaged from it. It's not the same thing as though you were sending all Americans were sending their sons and daughters to fight in Afghanistan. It's a very different situation. We have a particular segment of the population doing the lion's share of public service as far as fighting in our armed services. And that has all kinds of dangerous implications for democracy, in my view.
We've also seen the Department of Defense via contractors take over functions that used to be the sole domain of the Department of State, particularly things like reconstruction. How do projects tend to change in the hands of the DOD from the way they were handled under Department of State?
Well, it's a twofold problem, really. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Pentagon increasingly involved in reconstruction, which is problematic for all sorts of reasons that you're seeing in the news today because, you know, the U.S. military is a massive symbol of coercion rather than choice. And development really is about giving people choices so they can kind of shape their own destiny. So there's kind of a fundamental problem with having the military doing so much of the reconstruction work. There's also a problem, though, with contracting in wartime for reconstruction because you have these very large contracts. Money changes hands multiple times in a foreign country, and there are all kinds of opportunities for corruption. The other interesting thing to think about is who actually is doing this work of reconstruction. It's interesting that in Iraq, at least for the first part of the American intervention there, billions and billions of dollars of money flowed through contracts into Iraq for reconstruction, and that money wound up in the hands and pockets of everybody, really, except the Iraqi people, the very people we were trying to help. which, you know, obviously is problematic. If you're doing this to build democracy in Iraq, yet Iraqis aren't getting the jobs, third-party nationals and all sorts of other people are, that really poses a problem.
And in some cases under the system, it would seem that certain reconstruction projects cost like 10 times more via contractors than they would if they were done directly.
That's right. And, you know, there's kind of a tough call situation here, because sometimes you want to bring in outside personnel to ensure that the contract is fulfilled properly. And the big example there is Halliburton with fuel in Iraq. You know, you could have brought the fuel, you could have used an Iraqi supplier, and it would have been a lot cheaper. But at the same time, then the supply line would have been hostage to potential terrorist activities by, you know, the opposition. So instead, the fuel was brought in from Kuwait at much higher prices, and a lot of people said, well, that's Halliburton gouging the public. But the reality was, this was a way of ensuring that our forces had the fuel they needed for their operations.
We should say
it can be complicated.
That you are not, in fact, against government contracting per se, and in fact, you don't think, strictly speaking, that it's the contractors who are the problem.
That's right. That's right. And I stress this repeatedly in my book that, you know, when things go wrong, it's really easy for government to turn around and say, you know, private sector, you're the problem here. But the reality is that the government writes the contracts. The government asks the private sector to do certain things. So when things go wrong, it's really government that's responsible. And we've, in a sense, sort of lost that sense of responsibility.
Well, I wonder if you think that's part of the appeal for the government agencies that are hiring these contractors, is that they can sort of push culpability off onto somebody else.
Sure. I mean, it definitely is attractive. You kind of have plausible deniability when anything goes wrong. But it's not very good for accountability, and it's not very good for accomplishing the mission.
So the contracting sector has been characterized as a fourth branch of the federal government. If that is accurate, though, it's alarming given that it's a branch of government without any of the checks and balances that cover the other three.
That's really true. I mean, in the sense, what you get with contracts, it's one thing if you have a large contract, but most of these big contracts evolve into a whole chain of subcontracts, often changing hands, you know, five and six times. And the net result of that is that much of governance is rendered wholly opaque. You really can't see where the money is going or how things operate. So there's no way you can have accountability, let alone transparency.
Is it possible to make a blanket statement about the qualifications of the people who are hired to fulfill these contracts?
It really isn't, because there's so, you know, I guess the big distinction I would start off with is that there's a big difference between wartime and peacetime contracting, that a lot of the abuses we see associated with contracting are a result of doing it in wartime, in war zones, which has all kinds of high risks and hazards. But you can't really make a blanket statement about who's being hired, because it varies from, it's very different in Iraq and Afghanistan. In Iraq, I told you that, you know, Iraqis were not receiving the majority of the jobs. In Afghanistan, you do find that local nationals are getting the jobs, but there are still all kinds of problems.
Who's responsible for making sure that contracts are fulfilled according to what was written down in the first place?
Well, you know, it should be the person monitoring the contract, but what's happened over time is that we've had a real hollowing out of government, where the acquisitions personnel who used to do that in various agencies oversee the contracts have increasingly retired. So you've seen all kinds of practices where government really outsources oversight of the contract to the private sector, which has all kinds of conflict of interest problems.
And in some cases, there are firms that have very clearly not fulfilled their contracts, but they're still getting work.
Exactly. And that's really one of the big problems associated with the effort in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that firms, you know, you have firms like Blackwater who, you know, have State Department contracts and there's scandals associated with them, and so they've effectively rebranded themselves and given themselves a new name, but they still have government contracts.
Allison, how common is it for these firms to train their employees according to what are considered to be the sort of public relations standards that the U.S. Department of State in particular, but also Department of Defense, wants to create for its own employees?
You mean, are there training programs that make sure that they can fulfill the same?
Do they act, when they're dealing with people on the ground, are they under any obligation, or have they had any training to deal with people in a specific way that would reflect the sort of spirit that the United States wants to put out there?
Yeah, that's a really great point. There's no uniform training program because the contexts are so varied and different. But, I mean, that would be one way to address some of the abuses that we see, is to ensure that there's a common sense of what's acceptable and what's not.
Do you think there's reason to worry that lobbying by contractors might actually encourage us to remain engaged in conflicts or initiatives that are less in the national interest than in their corporate interest?
You know, I think that contractors are good people, and these companies are comprised of good people, and they in a sense, may be caught up in a system that encourages the wrong sorts of outcomes. So when I say that, you know, the reliance on contractors creates this lobby that has a vested interest in overseas operations, I'm not inferring that the people involved are bad. It's just the system has incentives that are probably problematic. Because you do see that there's this opportunity to make money from war.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people, interestingly, who have gone from the Department of Defense budget straight as employees, and then they move into the private sector and make a lot more.
Yes, exactly, and that's a standard pattern. You have this revolving door between business and government, and it's this interesting phenomenon, I think, where the business of government has become business. So much is outsourced to the private sector that you really do see a connection between what goes on in Congress and government doing this work. I mean, it's not just a lobbying thing. It really is government relying on the private sector for so much of its operations that creates a set of pressures in which the public interest can easily get lost.
Does the private sector actually have an influence over the kinds of policies that the United States is creating?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and they should, because if the private sector is doing so much of the work of government, you want it to have input. But I guess what I'd like to see more of is the private sector, instead of just focusing on short-term profitability, realizing that the system we've set in place, you know, is unsustainable, and so they really should have a vested interest in being part of the solution, as opposed to just lobbying for their particular interests. So I'd like to see more companies giving back in ways that they might not have done previously, and you're seeing more and more of that through the corporate social responsibility movement, for example.
I think that's
a positive development.
You make the point in the book that instead of reporting their profits quarterly, some system should be put in place to encourage these contractors to think more about long-term goals, not strictly financial goals for the company, but in achieving whatever the end is that the government has ordered.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, that's the whole problem in a nutshell, and that's how I see this contracting problem as being linked to a number of the other challenges we face, both with reform of the financial system and also with health care, is that we're really on the verge of a big debate in this country about the proper relationship between business and government. And I think what's happened is that we've kind of lost our sense of those things that only government can do well. We had a period of real market fundamentalism, and I'm all for the free market, and I think it delivers all kinds of wonderful things, but it can't do the work of government. Business is always, and rightfully so, going to be focused on the short term. Yet many of the problems we face are problems of sustainability. Things that are, you know, it's okay in the short run, but in the long run, if we continue our practices, we'll, you know, set up a situation where it's no longer possible to make money. So I'd like to make, you know, the private sector aware that when our practices are unsustainable, they're setting up a situation where it's not going to be possible for them to make money in the long run. So they have an interest in being part of the solution,
Allison,
even though it's not immediately obvious.
Allison Stanger is my guest. Her new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alison Stanger. She's Russell Lange 60 Professor of International Politics and Economics at Middlebury College. Her new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Alison, one really interesting element of the problem that comes out in the book is the reality that contracting is seen in Washington as a sort of specialty all of its own. So it tends to be handled in a separate realm from policymaking.
That's correct. And one of the big points in my book is really that we can no longer treat it that way, that contracting has become a strategic issue because it constitutes such a large proportion of the budgets of the State Department, the Pentagon, and USAID.
So how do you go through and break down those silos that have been around for a long time now?
I think you do it. It's part of the reason I wrote the book. You make people realize how the core business of foreign policy has changed, but our strategies and our frameworks for thinking about it have really lagged behind. And so you can treat contracting as a tactical issue if you think about it in kind of Cold War terms. But when you look at how much is going out the door in contracts and grants, it's 83% of the Pentagon's budget in 2008 went out the door in contracts, of the State Department's, 82% of the Pentagon's. So if it's that large a proportion of the budget, then it really has become a strategic issue and you need to treat it as such. But the first step is really to make people aware that's the case, and I think that's happening in Washington right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go first to Patrick in Richardson. Hello, Patrick.
Hello.
Hello, Patrick.
Hello. It's very fascinating. I can't wait to read the book. My question kind of has to do with a little bit about what you said, being contracting being a strategic issue, and it accounts for all so much money in the government and whatnot. You know, the average college graduate probably has never heard of USAID, much less its function in government.
That's true.
And, you know, it's interesting to think about what you said, like, you know, how in military terms, to really affect a difference in a country, it seems like you've got to have this term boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The eventual integration, possibly, of USAID into aspects of the Peace Corps and everything like that would allow, like, proverbial not boots on the ground, but, you know, even you could break it up into whether it's business shoes on the ground or just running shoes, but to create something that allows for us to implement some of our strategy after all this money is being allocated to primarily strategic and defense issues, where you can't implement these, plus with the recession in the economy, so many kids would love to explore the world as well. Do you think a change like that could possibly happen? And once again, fascinating show and fascinating subject. I'll take my question up here.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks so much. Well, I think you put your finger on an important issue, which is that, there's going to be very positive aspects to outsourcing in the development realm, where you really can have more of a sense of bottom-up possibilities, where you're giving the local population choices about their future and helping them to own it. That's in direct contrast to how some aid might have been given in the past, when the main way of doing that was for the U.S. government to give money to the government of another country. Well, we can see right now in Afghanistan why that's a problem. If the Karzai government is corrupt, you don't want to be giving the development money to the Karzai government. You'd rather give it to people on the ground who are doing things from the bottom up. But no, I think you're right that there's a real hunger in this country to want to know what they can do to make a difference. And I'm really hopeful that we can kind of turn ourselves from a nation of consumers back into a nation of citizens as we move forward in the years ahead. And there are a variety of ways that individuals can make a difference, and some of them might be in the developing world.
Alison, how do NGOs figure into the concerns you have about contracting in the 21st century?
That's a great question, because I like to talk about negative and positive aspects of outsourcing. And the negative ones are all the tales of corruption, waste, fraud, and abuse that are in the papers. But the positive ones are often lost, because outsourcing really is a way of, in a sense, allowing individuals to make a difference. It's really true. It really isn't untrue to say that today it's possible for individuals to make their own foreign policy, kind of over the heads of government, when government falls short. So you have examples of organizations, NGOs like Kiva, which is an NGO that makes it possible for you know, people in the West or Americans to directly fund aspiring entrepreneurs in the developing world via PayPal. So this is even true in Iraq. They listed a whole range of projects to fund in Iraq in 2007 with a big disclaimer that this was a high-risk situation. Lenders to these entrepreneurs should take that into mind when they consider making their loans. Yet in less than 3 hours, all of the projects had been funded, primarily by American citizens who apparently wanted to lend a personal hand to the Iraqi reconstruction effort. So here's you know, individual citizens, in a sense, making development policy without the government involved. And there are a range of other examples where that's so. And that can be a very positive thing. Outsourcing can be a positive force for change because in something like Kiva, it's not like you have a big Made in the USA stamped on the head of the project. It really is something that the local population owns, and that's precisely what you need to build sustainable development.
Alison Stanger is my guest. The new book is called One Nation Under Contract. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next with John in Dallas. Hey, John.
Good afternoon. I had a question for Alison regarding her comment about the struggle between the short-term interests of private sector firms and the long-term goals of government. My question is regarding contract structure. Why can't government create a contract structure that addresses the risk and rewards of these long-term goals? For instance, when a contract's developed and long-term goals are agreed on between the firm and the government, why can't the firm submit data and other information to the government regarding their progress on reaching some of these long-term goals if they don't meet some of those process outcomes, then they would have a risk incurred on that firm, financial risk or penalty. If they are meeting those long-term goals through these data and metrics, then they would be rewarded.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. I mean, you're absolutely right. Government can write better contracts. But I think a prerequisite for that is acknowledging how important contracting is to the work of government. You're not going to get that result if you think of it as something peripheral, a kind of, you know, esoteric specialty, as opposed to something that's really at the heart and soul of governance today. So there's all kinds of things we can do to write better contracts. You know, we can ban cost-plus contracts, which are a recipe for overspending. We can ensure that there's really a free market for bids, which isn't often the case. There are a lot of no-bid contracts. So there's all sorts of things we could do better to ensure greater efficiency and cost-effectiveness.
Continue.
No, I just wanted to say that, you know, that's government's job.
Rather than the contractors making these reforms.
Right. I mean, they're executing what government asked them to do.
Yeah, I wanted to ask if you think there is ever an appropriate role for no-bid contracting.
You know, there can sometimes be an appropriate role for that in highly specialized weapon systems. I can see how, you know, it's hard to really imagine how you would construct a free market for really complicated, high-technology weapon systems.
Because you can't put that bid out there publicly.
Yeah, but, you know, no bid is problematic. I can see how you could at least have a competition between two or three companies that were doing the same thing. But it is true that in the realm of weaponry, it can often be hard to ensure that, you know, free market principles prevail. But we should still strive to do so, in my view.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Rick in Lancaster. Hello, Rick.
Hi,
Rick.
Hello. I was thinking that if the government was liable for things committed by the contractors, you know, Blackwater, et cetera, and that there was, you know, they were able to fine them or not pay them on their contract if they, you know, committed the atrocities or the government got sued on it or whatever, that might help balance it out. I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks for your
help. No, you're absolutely right, you know, because government has the power. If a contractor messes up and they don't like what they've done, they can fire the, you know, they can not sign another contract with that company. But that's where this difference between wartime and peacetime contracting really comes in, because in a wartime situation, you do have the sense that, my God, we need to have these contracts fulfilled. We need to have, you know, the bodies over there. And so it's a lot easier to look the other way and turn a blind eye to practices that we wouldn't normally tolerate. And I think that's very much the situation in Afghanistan today.
What responsibility, if any, does the federal government hold to employees, U.S. Citizen employees of these private contracting firms who find themselves kidnapped or captured or wounded? That does that all of that liability rest with the company that hired them?
I think it does, yeah. Mm-hmm. It really does, and it's also up to the companies. Well, the legal situation is very complicated because when you're in a foreign country, you have competing legal systems, but I think you can see with the number of contracting abuses and the relatively small number of actions that are taken by companies against those abuses, you have a problem there. But it really does fall to the company to police actions. And that's where you get this, remember the strange Franken Amendment, where Kellogg, Brown, and Root had written into their contract that their employees working overseas couldn't sue for rape. So that's a real example, I think, of the company's rules reigning supreme, even though I think that was illegal.
Do you think Americans place an appropriate amount of either trust or mistrust in people who go to work for these agencies? There seems to be people hold private contractors in a far lower esteem than they might hold a soldier doing the same job.
That's really true, and it also creates all kinds of morale problems within the U.S. military when, you know, soldiers see someone driving a truck and they're a contractor doing essentially the same job and making three times as much. So you have a real tension there. But you have another tension in terms of young people today who want to work for government, who want to be public servants. I spoke on the Hill on Friday and spoke to some young congressional staffers who really would like to work for the State Department. They'd like to work for the Department of Defense, but they're being told, you know, the way to do this, the entry level, is work for a contractor first, doing work for the Department of Defense or the State Department, and that should satisfy you. Whereas they're saying, I don't want to work for a private company. I want to work for my country. I want to work for the government. So you have that kind of a situation today where it can be hard to get a government job and a lot easier to get a job with a contracting firm who works for the government.
Alison Stanger is my guest. Her new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Deborah in Allen. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Deborah.
Go right ahead, please.
Yeah. I was wondering, to what extent have you seen that potential contractors, if not, say, the preferred contractor, is actually writing the specifications? You were disparaging government earlier in the program for not providing adequate specifications, but, you know, I see in various media intimations that the, you know, in some situations, a company like Blackwater, for example, has the opportunity to actually write the specifications. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, clearly that gives whoever that contractor might be a leg up. Is that something that you've seen in your research?
Absolutely. Deborah, that's a really great point, because when government is shorthanded, as it is today, that's a pretty easy thing to happen, to have the company write specifications. But it's not necessarily in the public interest. But I don't think people really realize the extent to which our government is today but a shadow of its former self. I like to cite one big statistic that really surprises people. If you look at the federal workforce in 2008, you know, the number of employees, you will find that there's the exact same number of employees in 2008 as there were in 1963. Yet the size of the federal budget in that same period in real terms has more than tripled. So that gap is at least in part filled by contractors. You have each government employee overseeing vastly larger sums of money. So if that's the case, you can see how you might say, you know, I'd like to really give this contract closer scrutiny, but I'm going to have to let the company carry the ball here. And that's precisely what we need to change, in my view.
Let's talk about the fiscal value of using contractors. Is it typically cheaper to hire a company to do this work, outsource this work, than it is to set up a department within the federal government to carry it out?
That's a really interesting question. And again, it's going to vary about with the type of work done. But if you look at wartime contracting, say take security contractors, I've seen all kinds of studies to suggest that it doesn't save money. And I have yet to see one convincing study that shows that it does. So there's this assumption that if we use the private sector, it saves money. But the evidence really isn't there.
So where did we come to this ethos that big government was bad and that everything would be better served by private contractors?
Well, I think it's understandable how we got there. You know, you have Ronald Reagan, who starts off by saying that, you know, government is the problem, not the solution. Ronald Reagan got a lot of things right, but I think he was really wrong on that, because you do need government. But I think we have sort of lost our sense of what government is for, and we need to recapture that.
At this point in our history, especially given the economic crisis, is sustaining the current level of contracting critical to the stability of our economy?
I have not studied that in detail, but I think we want to see the right kinds of contracting and get rid of the ones that are the types that are problematic. So the argument that I make is, you know, we don't want insourcing, because that's the standard reaction of a lot of people when they see, you know, tales of abuse is, oh my God, this has gone too far. Let's bring it all back in-house. But I would argue that we don't need insourcing. We need smart sourcing. We need to bring back in-house those things that shouldn't have been outsourced and continue to outsource those things that serve us well, with appropriate oversight, of course. So that's the big challenge at hand, to review our current practices and decide which ones don't make sense and which ones do.
Alison Stanger is my guest. Her new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. We'll take more of your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Middlebury College Professor of International Politics and Economics Alison Stanger is here this hour. Her new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Alison, what role can the media play in ensuring that Americans know what we're really paying for?
Well, that's really a great question, because so much of moving forward on these issues is going to depend on what the media does. If they start to highlight some of the problems that my book addresses, you'll get some momentum for changing things. Otherwise, without media attention, politics as usual will continue.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Paul in Plano. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I would like to comment that when the Vietnam War was happening, there were no contractors, private contractors in the war. And I think that some great brain trust politician came up with this idea of hiring contractors so that they wouldn't have to put American military on the ground to cover, to take up the slack that we need. And the reason for this, of course, is because in order to get enough military, they would have had to institute the draft. The draft would have been the kiss of death for this war that everybody except the people are making so much money off of.
Mm-hmm.
I find it despicable that they resort to this tactic to dull the war, to dull the American people to the effects of the war. And if I could make one more comment, I would like to wonder what the Republicans would have done if Clinton had been the chairman of a company and then gave them a no-bid contract as soon as he got into office. And I'll listen to this off the air. Thank you very much.
That's an interesting point. Paul, you're absolutely right that these are our first two contractors wars, and I call them that in my book. But interestingly enough, in Vietnam, we did use contractors, though by no means to the extent we do today. If you look at the percentage of contractors as a percentage of the total force in Vietnam when our troop levels were the highest, contractors did constitute 13%, 13% of the American presence on the ground. But as I said earlier, today, the majority of our presence on the ground is comprised of contractors. So that is a huge difference.
Am I correct, though, that we started using Halliburton during the Clinton administration?
Yes, absolutely. And there were some really interesting uses of private security contractors to great effect under the Clinton administration in the former Yugoslavia, for example, where private security contractors were really instrumental in tipping the balance in the war. They were training the Croatian army, and their presence made the difference that in terms of bringing the Serbs to the negotiating table. There would have been no Dayton Peace Accords without the use of private security contractors in the Balkans. So, yes, it does start under the Clinton administration.
1-800,
not a partisan issue.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Lourdes in Dallas. Hi, Lourdes.
Hi. Hi, this is Lourdes.
Hi.
Hi, Lourdes.
I have two quick points. I've contracted with government for 20 years as a physician recruiter, mostly in the commercial business, but my contracts with the VA, one goes towards efficiency, and one value that we provide with anesthesiologists that are contracted in the ORs is because they go in with the as independent contractors and can be dispelled if they don't do a good job, they go in there with a very efficient, set a quick pace for the OR, and that is a value, getting the efficiency out of somebody that is expendable, if you will, that I think contributes to the VA hospital systems, for instance, and I would imagine it would apply to others. Mm-hmm. My other point, I worked with the Parkland Hospital as a physician recruiter, and I came into the job saying I want to provide a revenue-producing department where we can recruit, do the insourcing, and make some money. And, of course, they love the idea, but at the end, we couldn't write policy, so there would be something in it for us. And I think the problem with the federal government is that they think people can be content with a salary to work harder, and there's no incentive or business-minded sense in producing a revenue producing commissions or sales type of incentive to make insourcing a possibility.
Thanks
and
for
I'll
your call.
I'll take your feedback off the air.
Thanks. Yeah. Allison, what do you think?
No, I think that's an excellent point. In many instances, this really is a question of government providing the right sort of incentives to the private sector. In my book, I talk about how government needs to do things to cultivate the market for virtue. In other words, action that does have our long-run interests in mind. Government can provide incentives for that, then the private sector can become part of the solution as opposed to just looking out for profitability in ways that serve its interests as well as the interests of all of us. So incentives are absolutely, absolutely key.
Define virtue as it applies to the situation.
Well, that's a great question. Virtue, in my view, would be looking out for the interests of this country as a whole, as opposed to your own particular interests, and you can even generalize that to be looking out for the interests of the global community. So if you look at problems like, say, take climate change, government can really provide incentives for the private sector to think about sustainability that it might not do on its own. And for any kind of problem that requires long-term attention over the long haul rather than short-term thinking, government is absolutely critical in providing the right incentive structures to encourage the private sector to address that problem and see it as an opportunity for making money. So there are all kinds of things that government can do to foster what I call the market for virtue.
Does that mean even across disciplines? So, you know, when you talk about climate change, we can immediately think of green businesses and people who are working to make this happen. Mm-hmm. Does it also make sense to maybe give some priority to a food service contractor who makes an effort to waste less and to use less paper product despite the cost?
That's another great example. I mean, really, there, you know, there are as many examples as creative individuals can think of, but they all have one thing in common, that government is really setting incentives that encourage individuals and private actors to work for the common good.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Tony in Dallas. Hello, Tony.
Hi.
Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yeah, I am a food service contractor. I'm in Dallas, Texas. I have my food service and event management company. Bid it on a contract from in D.C. And the reason that the Air Force Department of Defense chose my contract was because I've always had a sustainability and green initiative in my business.
That's great.
Since day one. And as a small business, because of the economic downturn, I suffered a major, major loss. Mm. And I turned to government contracting on the advice of my brother, who works for a government contractor, and said, you should sell your concept to United States Air Force, because what you have is what they're looking for. And and now I'm headed out to D.C. Starting in January to service the United States Air Force. And they are probably the hardest defense contractors to satisfy.
Mm-hmm.
They have been very wonderful in providing me what I need, the marketing. And as a small business owner, it has saved me a lot. It has saved my business. Because I suffered a lot during this economic downturn.
Well, sure. Tony, I'm so glad it's working out for you. It sounds like she's a great example of how this can work.
Exactly, and you can do things to encourage small businesses too. That's also going to foster market competition. You know, because it's big monopolies that stifle the free market, and small businesses are often sources of great and positive innovation. So it's good to hear that's working for you.
Let's go next on the phone to Trent in Dallas. Hello, Trent.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
All right. By way of background, I work for the Department of Defense for one of the obscure agencies called Defense Contract Management Agency that administers a lot of these private contracts.
Oh, it's great to talk
about.
To you.
Yes. My history goes back more than 20 years, and I've been watching these events, and frankly, the big break-in for the private contracts in the military started in the 91 Gulf War, mm-hmm. when basically the military turned to private contractors to do logistics because they didn't have the people in the reserves to do the support in that particular theater since it was so underdeveloped. And mm-hmm. you had all these oil field people that were readily available with trucks and third world drivers to do the job.
Right.
This was picked up by the Clinton administration in places like East Timor and the Balkans, and mm-hmm. pretty much it's been a bipartisan affair from then to now, at least in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
This is, and in the interim, my agency went from about 20,000 people to around 10,000 people, mm-hmm. and at any one time we're responsible for about 3 years' worth of Defense Department budget, which means, 10,000 people, about $1 trillion in over 3 years. You know, our cooks and bottle washers are responsible for $100 million, except we contract that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Has it been harder for you to operate with fewer employees?
Yes and no. The biggest issue that we have had as an agency has been doing contingency contracting while our workforce was contracting about 4% a year during the entirety of the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Essentially, from 2001 until 2008, we were taking a 4% per year personnel cut while we were expected to support contingency operations and everything else at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only do so much, you can't do more with less, you do less with less, and you've got to pick your battles.
Right.
And it's been an ongoing fight to figure out which battles to pick, and sometimes, as the GA reports from time to time show, we can only do so much with so little.
Trent, before we let you go, very briefly, is there an adversarial relationship between you and the contractors that you're working with, or, in fact, do you feel more like partners?
It depends on the contractor. KBR and Dynacorp and some of the others have varying reputations depending on who their current management is, and that's an ever-changing panoply of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
It really depends a lot, frankly, on the politics behind it with Congress than it does on what's going on between the contractors and agencies like my own.
Sure.
A lot of the reason that at least the people in civil service feel that we're seeing a lot of the contracting out has to do with financial incentives for congressional campaigns more than anything else. Because if you've got lots of contractors battling for contracts, putting money into different congressional campaigns for reelection seems to have a positive effect on what's awarded and what is not.
Right. Trent, thank you so much for your call. Is there so much to think about there, Allison? Is there anything you want to comment on?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight one point about the hiring of third-party nationals, which is important to realize that it's not necessarily Americans who are getting the jobs, and it's not necessarily Iraqis or Afghans. If you look at the embassy in Baghdad, for example, that was built entirely by the new American embassy in Baghdad was built entirely by third-party nationals. Really, no Iraqis working on that site for a variety of reasons. But that's something to keep in mind with our development projects. We want to think about who it is that's receiving the money.
Another recommendation you have here is that we create a single pool of money for our national security budget that would pay for defense and diplomacy and homeland security. What would that change as opposed to keeping them separated in the way that they have been all this time?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a utopian dream. But it would change everything, in my view, because what we have, right, you know, the threats of the 21st century differ so radically from those of the Cold War. You know, our biggest threat is not another country today. It's this network of malevolent forces bent on the West's destruction. It's terrorism. I mean, you fight that in a very different way than you would the Soviet Union. So you have this new Department of Homeland Security that's sprung up. Yet all the old budgets remain the same. So when you appropriate money, it's within each of those silos when it would be so much better to think in terms of the security of the homeland and appropriate money as part of one large pool, a unified national/homeland security budget. It's not impossible to get there, but there are all kinds of obstacles to making that a reality, but I think it would really do a lot to solve some of the problems I've identified.
Where do you suggest we go to keep up with who's getting what contracts and for how much money?
Well, you really should take a look at usaspending.gov. Mm-hmm. This is it's a user-friendly website. It really tells you exactly how your taxpayer money is spent. It's supposed to render contracting wholly transparent, and it's really legislation spearheaded by then-Senator Obama. So this is really a pet initiative of President Obama. He's deeply committed to transparency. But go to that website and take a look at it. It's usaspending.gov, and you'll find all the information you want on contracts, all the information you want on grants.
I'm so sorry, we're out of time. Allison Stanger's new book is called One Nation Under Contract, The Outsourcing of American Power and the Future of Foreign Policy. Allison, it's been a very informative hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
It's been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.